The last time Albie was on the program, and I should point out he's a former judge in South Africa's Constitutional Court, a prolific writer, and an absolutely heroic anti-apartheid crusader. Last time, it was to talk about his quite beautifully written jail diaries and other aspects of his extraordinary life. I told you that he's paid dearly for his convictions. He's lost his right arm, the sight in one eye, during an attempted assassination thing during the dark days of apartheid. He's endured long stretches of solitary, but he has this miraculous gift, not uncommon amongst his comrades, to come out of all this with an absolutely unbroken human spirit, and in Albie's case, a considerable sense of humour. He's back in the country. He's on a tour to launch and promote his new book, The Strange Alchemy of Life and Law. Not a bad title. Albie, welcome back.
Thank you.
There's a lot to talk about, but a few relevant facts about your life. You grew up in a country, South Africa, where, as I was telling the listener earlier, almost everything you believed, thought and did was against the law. How did that lead you to a career in the law?
It's funny, you were giving that biography, it sounded so grim. And yet I look back on my life as actually having been joyous, because we achieved what we set out to achieve, basically. And it wasn't only just getting rid of apartheid, you know, getting away from something wicked. I think everybody here following the World Cup could see what our country was capable of. There was a kind of a sense of freedom and togetherness and rebellion and fun that was really very, very, very special. Of course, it's not like that all the time. We've got very, very heavy problems. But I just wish when people speak about, it's not just my life, but, you know, the life of people in my generation, marvelous figures like Nelson Mandela, others not so well known. There's been a lot of humor and joy and song, and in my case, working on the Constitutional Court was I think of it as something like, you know, these extreme sports where people climb up huge mountains and they jump off on roller skates, and intellectually, it was sort of like that. How did it start? It started actually with my dad, Solly, and my mom, Ray. Solly was a trade union leader, garment workers union, organizing workers of all backgrounds and colors to fight for their rights as workers, but also as citizens. My mom, Ray, very, very diffident. I once called her the memoirs of a revolutionary typist. So the men would make revolution during the day and play cards at night, and she would type up the minutes then. But I grew up in a very activist home.
And, of course, you grew up in a home where both the families had fled the pogroms of Europe.
I'm sure that was an important factor. I mean, Lithuania seemed then and today very, very far away for me. But I did hear stories about come Easter and the Cossacks would come to the villages where the Jews were living and say, the Jews killed Christ, we're going to kill the Jews, and they would kill. And people hid in cellars in the basements, they ran to the forests. So there was a knowledge of persecution. And
Albie, a defiance of it. One of the things I like is that you say that being a Jew was also a part of that, being the underdog. I never let anti-Semitic remarks go by, or anti-Irish, or anti-black.
Yes. Are you saying that, or are you quoting me?
I'm quoting you.
Absolutely. And I would add today anti-gay, anti-woman. Any group that's been subjected to forms of marginalization, exclusion, it's just not funny to ridicule people who've suffered a lot of pain because they are who they are. Thanks for quoting that bit.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely bit. And, of course, your dad was in the Communist Party. How powerful, how influential was that at the time?
I think in terms of shaping ideas of non-racism, of internationalism, of a kind of disciplined form of struggle where you're in it not to gain riches and wealth and so on, it was very, very important. In terms of numbers, not so huge. Solly was actually expelled for what was called right-wing deviationism. Yeah, you laugh today.
Well, mate, I remember then when we were expelling members of the Australian Communist Party on the same charge. So.
Right.
yeah. But it's interesting, isn't it? The Communist Party didn't have to be big in a nation to be influential.
I think its strongest feature was enabling people to get away from looking at the world purely in terms of race and to project this idea, particularly to the oppressed, that it wasn't because the oppressors as individuals, as persons, were inherently wicked and bad, had to be removed from the face of the earth. It was a system under which one lived, whether it's colonial domination or economic exploitation. And I think that helped pave the way for one of the ingredients in the ANC, which was a much broader kind of a movement and picked up from Christianity, it picked up from Gandhi, it picked up very strongly from African humanist spirit called Ubuntu. But I think the socialist ideas, the internationalist ideas that were brought to South Africa and generated in South Africa through the Communist Party certainly played a very, very important role.
You grew up in a police state, and for a long time it must have seemed as though the regime was eternal, that it would never be defeated.
No, never, 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 never. And it wasn't just a kind of historical optimism. We knew the world was against apartheid and increasingly vocal, and I'm happy to say Australia played a very good role. There were lots of very vocal people in this country, but multiply that by 50, and we were the majority, and it was such an unjust system, and we were right. So we never felt it was hopeless. We did feel sometimes we would wonder, would I have the courage to hang in there? Would I die? I mean, when I was blown up and I realized in the darkness that I'd survived, I felt euphoric, because as a freedom fighter, you're waiting for the day when they come for you. Will I be brave? Will I get through it? Will I survive? And they'd come for me and they'd blown me up and I'd only lost an arm, and I actually felt fantastic.
Well, there's a wonderful question which I shall quote of yours. How hard it is to be brave. There must have been moments when you wished for a somewhat easier life.
I wished for the pain to go away. I wished for the misery of isolation, solitary confinement. I wished for that sense of personal disgrace and defeat as I felt my will crumbling under sleep deprivation. Long moments like that. There were times when I was out of prison and I saw things happening around me, comrades who were cracking up, who broke down, discovering spies in our ranks, living with dread all the time. It wasn't plain sailing by any means, but the conviction that the cause was just, we used to say freedom in my lifetime, freedom in our lifetime was our slogan. We were quite young then, we envisaged we would have quite long lives, but we did see freedom in our lifetime.
Did you suffer as much in exile as you had in prison? Was exile as problematic?
No, of a different order. Exile cost, because you away from your country, your home, the people you like, people you hate. It's. I couldn't get excited about the political opponents in other countries in the same way that I'd get angry about political opponents in South Africa. And that's all part of your identity. But it was never the same. And I saw exile as an opportunity to learn about other countries. I would submerge myself totally, always saying, I'm taking home what I'm learning. So I never had the problem, am I South African and am I English? I'm South African, I'm in England, I was there a long time. Am I South African, am I Mozambican? I'm South African, I was in Mozambique. But I would take back with me. I found it a very enriching couple of decades.
This is LNL, ABC Radio National, etc. My guest is Albie Sachs, activist and judge on the Constitutional Court in South Africa. When Mandela was elected, he appointed you as a judge in the new Constitutional Court. It must have been a great and exquisite honour.
It was. It was the culmination of, in a personal biography, everything from sitting down as a second-year law student on a seat marked blacks only, as part of what we call the Defiance of Unjust Laws campaign, of being present when we adopted the Freedom Charter that already envisaged democratic South Africa, and decades later helping to write, being one of the great bunch of people helping to write the new constitution, voting as an equal for the first time.
Probably one of the two or three greatest documents of the century.
Well, thanks for saying that. I happen to agree. I won't pretend any modesty about it. And it came about through 6 years of wrangling, arguing, fighting, but eventually looking into the eyes of the other, finding a way through. And we even had an English language expert to cut out the hereinafters and the words like contemplate and so on, to make it more accessible. And then to be put on the court that's defending the very things we've been fighting for, it was like I was in a fable, a very beautiful, wonderful fable, but I'm not reading about somebody else, I'm actually experiencing it myself.
LB, you'd always advocated a Bill of Rights. We flirt with the nation here, some of us are passionately for it, and it gets quite improbable opposition from people who should know better. How important is a Bill of Rights in your view?
Well, I'm a convert, and like many converts, I exaggerate the importance of it. I was very sceptical early on. I just felt, leave it all to Parliament. You can't trust the judges with people's rights. Parliament is elected and answerable to the people. Our experience has been very, very different. It's not as though the judges are there using the Bill of Rights against Parliament. It's like a sort of a conversation, a constant reminder of certain deep values, and it gives coherence. It doesn't depend just on goodwill of those who are elected to office. There's a certain objective set of standards. It's got an international dimension, and it's been very unifying in South Africa because one feels the Bill of Rights covers everybody, and it doesn't depend who is the Prime Minister today or tomorrow, who is appointed Home Secretary or Minister of the Interior. It doesn't depend on any of those things. It has a kind of an active life of its own as the Bill of Rights, which recognises all South Africans, black, white, brown, rich, poor, whatever languages they speak. And we found it immensely supportive of the deepening of democracy in our country. It's not anti-democratic. It's democratic in the sense of recognising everybody, whether you belong to a majority or minority, if you live in the country or in the towns, somehow the Bill of Rights is that equalizing factor.
The beautiful voice and considered wisdom of LB Sachs. LB, you, I meant to ask you this earlier. I know that you feel that culture and the arts have an incredibly influential or important role in giving a nation soul. When, in the dark days of struggle, did you find time to read outside the immediate terms of reference of politics?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, before I became active, I used to read a lot of poetry. And what actually propelled me into politics was poetry. I went to a lecture given by an Afrikaans writer called Ace Krige in Cape Town. I was 17 at the time, and he spoke about a Spanish poet called Lorca. I didn't even know they had poets in Spain.
He's a great poet, Lorca.
I didn't know. Yeah. I knew they had bullfights. So, you know, I had the usual stereotypical view. And Lorca was executed by the fascists during the Civil War. And we heard most exquisite, beautiful poetry. And what that session did for me is it linked up the soul of poetry, the intimacy, the inwardness of it, with the big public events of the world. And I was ready. I was finished, if you like. And so it was culture, in a way, that brought me into politics. And so once I was in politics, I became very interested in the great Mexican mural artists who were doing stories of the ancient Aztecs, the Mexican revolutionaries who fought against the Spanish, in public art for the people out there, and revolutionizing artistic representation. And all of this inspired me. But in terms of literature, I don't know why. Well, I had to at some stage during my exile read Proust just because he represented this high mountain of European literature that I felt was too towering. And once I'd climbed up that mountain, I was never intimidated or scared of European literature again, and actually got an enormous amount of pleasure out of it. And I would have my favorite authors. I had a Balzac period, and of course Dostoevsky earlier on. I discovered a Spanish writer, Galdós. I don't know why he isn't up there with all the others. Magnificent writing. So literature did mean a lot to me during all the years. The Magic Mountain, which I kind of understood and didn't really understand Thomas Mann.
Do you know, the first book which I read about South Africa as a very young man, which influenced me, was Cry the Beloved Country of Alan Paton. There was a great before the destruction of apartheid, South Africa was producing some fine literature. Is there a new wave of cultural expression coming out of your South Africa?
Yes, certainly. There's an intermediate wave. It's no accident that Nadine Gordimer and James Coetzee, two South Africans.
Now an Australian.
Yes, now he's in Australia, but he's South African born, and he got the Nobel Prize for work that he did while he was South African. But I'm saying this not to brag, saying this just to say that literary intelligence has been extremely important in our country. And now there's a completely new generation of new authors, black and white, and many of them are writing satirical work, they're writing work about marginals, they're writing with a new kind of a voice. So the literary scene is sparky, and I expect a lot to come from it. We have terrific contemporary dance. We're amongst world leaders in that area. A magnificent choral singing. We have also the worst sound in the world. I'm speaking about the vuvuzela, which I hope we don't export, that you would have heard during the World Cup. Our visual arts are very intense, very strong, as good as anywhere in the world.
Is a society willing to countenance writers of fiction and non-fiction who are critical of the new South Africa?
Oh, yes. I mean, most of the writers are critical in one way or the other, through fun, through satire, through the sort of challenges they feel the new society is projecting. We have, in fact, a huge new band of stand-up comedians. It's been quite breathtaking in the last about 4 or 5 years, from all communities. And they really go for anybody in authority and power. And I think it's really healthy for our society.
I had no idea that you were spawning stand-ups. I think that's wonderful. Now, let me ask you this. You write a lot, and others have, of course, as well. It's a constant preoccupation of people of your calling, about law and justice being different things. But I think you express the difference with greater clarity than most. Law is the abstract idea of a system. Justice is its application. What's the relationship now between law and justice in your country, given that so many of your laws were obscene and there was no justice?
Well, we've got possibly the most advanced, comprehensive constitution in the world. So the basic law is tremendous, and many statutes that have been passed by the new democratically elected government have been excellent. On the other hand, there's some that we on the court struck down, even after democracy, even adopted by the democratic parliament, as violating certain provisions of the constitution. There's a huge debate on right now about proposed press tribunal and a bill to deal with access to security information. The good part is our country is lively. People speak their minds. They speak out. We're not afraid to speak our minds. We don't have the degree of personal security that's equal to the liberty that we enjoy. Some important moves have been made in that direction. But it's a very spirited society, and I just enjoy enormously living there. It's interesting. Things are not predictable in the way that they are in many other what are called mature democracies. The unpredictability at times can be challenging, But I think it makes everybody feel there's something I can do, there's a role for me, you can really contribute, make a difference, whether it's in broadcasting or the press or writing, whatever field it might be.
Albie, one of the reasons you're with us at the moment is to launch your new book. This happens on Wednesday night in Sydney. And dear listener, please see our website for details. But you say you wrote your book for Oliver, your young son,
yes,
who had recently learned to use that wonderful word, why. And this greatly delighted you. Now, he won't have to fight the battles you had to fight, or hopefully won't have to ask many of the difficult questions you've had to ask. What do you hope for him? What do you see for him in South Africa?
I don't know. And it's wonderful not to know, because before one could predict a cruel, unjust, evil society. And then the only question was, would he resist, would he not? If he did resist, like my mom had to see her son, the doctor, my brother, go to hospital for an operation, her son, the lawyer, that's me, go to jail. And those were hard areas, but it was lined up. Now the freedom we've won means he can be anything, do anything. I don't know how it's going to go. He happens to be a terrific kid. I think everybody should think their children are marvelous. I think that about Oliver, but just on top of that, between you and me, he is marvelous. He'll be 4 in October, and it was great when he asked that question, why. And he is very curious about the world, and he'll find his own way. And I think our generation, in that sense, we've got to step aside and give way to new horizons and new possibilities.
Last time you were on our little wireless program, you told us how you'd met one of the men who planted the bomb which nearly killed you, and of the process it took to forgive him. Now it's many years later, and I ask again, is that sort of forgiveness really possible?
I wouldn't say it's possible. It's actual. And I don't even regard it as forgiveness. It's he took the steps that I found very, very appropriate. He went to the Truth Commission. He told the truth of what he'd done about the planting of the bomb in my car. He was upfront about it. And by doing that, in effect, he was distancing himself not from the shame of what he'd done, but from an allegiance to what he'd done. He was making himself a citizen of the new South Africa on equal terms, because he had kind of come clean. And I ended up shaking his hand when I heard that he'd done these things. I almost fainted after I heard that. I don't feel, he didn't say to me, Justice Sachs or Albie, sorry I blew off your arm. You can't say that. It's kind of bizarre. He did what he needed to do, and that was identify himself as somebody who accepted the new constitution, accepted the Truth Commission, joined in that kind of project. Not many of the soldiers did that. He did that.
I should remind the listener that you were instrumental in forming the commission, which of course has spawned commissions of varying quality all over the world. It's been an interesting phenomenon to observe, hasn't it?
A very important one. And I think we've also underlined the value of apology, of facing up to the past, of acknowledging connection with the past, responsibility for what happened. And the way the past, as somebody said, the big thing about the past is it isn't past. It's still with us. And through apology, you're acknowledging historic hurt that's been caused to people, that has its sequels today. And I think it's very, very meaningful, even if only at the symbolical level to begin with. And it's been notable, obviously you'll know, it's been controversial in this country, but the Prime Minister apologized for certain actions.
Not controversial on this program, I assure you.
In Canada, it's been done. Bill Clinton apologized, again, for a very specific thing. The British had the Bloody Sunday inquiry. That was their way of doing it. It went on for years and years and years. It was very expensive and time-consuming. But in the end, the judge stated that the troops had fired in a completely unjustified way into the crowd, and there was no excuse for doing it.
Albie, we've got to wind up. I hate this because I'd like to talk to you for hours, but it's a great honour to have you back, the wonderful Albie Sachs. On our next, I talk to an investigative journalist, starfighter for The New Yorker, John Lee Anderson, who's recently been to Iran to interview Ahmadinejad. And we'll hear the extraordinary story about the Australian criminal playwright Jim McNeil. Stay tuned now on ABC Radio National for the news by Albie Sachs' book, and we'll see you later.